Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. We've got a very special guest. We've got James Knight here from the Sisters Pastoral Company at Mortlake in Victoria. So welcome to the Angus Table podcast, James.
Awesome. Thanks, Scotty. And great to be here and especially the opportunity to do this while I'm off farm and thinking a lot more clearer than when I'm on farm. And again, to be part of this Gen Angus leadership program has been amazing. And also yesterday, getting up to see some really close friends on the Northern Tablelands that are under a heap of pressure season-wise at the moment, mate. So it's been a couple of great days so far.
As James just mentioned, we're here at Gunganoo Station, just outside of Tamworth for the annual Gen Angus program, which is a really great one for Angus Australia, something we're really proud of. James, you had a little bit of a connection with how this actually got going. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I came back into cattle a little bit later in life, back in 2016, after a corporate background, and I knew that the Angus cattle we had were going to be very significant or an important part of driving business growth going forward. So funnily enough, I decided to put an application in for the Angus Youth Consultative Committee at the time, which is pretty random, and found myself in a room of people that had generally a heavy showing cattle background, had been involved in cattle all their life. And I just think it was just very interesting coming into that room with a fresh set of eyes, basically, mate. And to answer your question about Gen Angus, well, at the time, there was nothing other than Roundup. So Roundup was still continues to be today, but a really pillar event for the Angus society and the breed, but we had nothing else. So I was fortunate enough to have done the Rabobank Farm Managers Program when I was younger, a week-long intensive program, leadership program, which really taught me a hell of a lot. So my thought bubble was around whether we could do a leadership program similar, basically. And that's basically where it started. And I wouldn't have dreamt that today, you know, we have over 50 people apply. The applications are fantastic now. And the selection committees having to work really hard to work out who actually gets in, mate. So it's just a great story, but I'm really grateful to still be involved and be able to get around them each year. It's very energizing for me, and you can only hope that they just take a, you know, few points out of where our journey's taken us so far. So that's my background in the program.
Yeah. Excellent, James. And look, thank you. It's encouragement to anyone that goes to a meeting or a workshop and puts a thought bubble out there on the table that actually it did get across the line. I think we've had over 60 people go through the program now. It's supported by ACMA Insurance, strong supporters of the program. And the feedback we get is it's great for these young leaders coming through the breed. So thank you, mate, for your part of getting something established, which is really important for our breed. James, one of the unique parts of your story. So for the listeners today, we've got a very successful commercial Angus operator in the breed. So we're really keen to hear your insights there. You're quite a dynamic businessman. And I guess quite uniquely, James, you made the transition from, I guess, urban Australia, city Melbourne, to running a fairly big cattle operation. Tell us, how did that go about? I've heard this story a couple of times. Tell the listeners exactly how you transitioned from a private schoolboy in Melbourne to cocky at
that's right. I just got the bug so early for ag, but it was through my uncle and auntie at Deniliquin, who had a property up there at Denny, and they had a pole Hereford stud and a fair bit of cropping. And I got taken up there a lot as a kid, and something just grabbed me there, and I basically never wanted to leave the farm. You know, Mum and Dad talk about stories of, you know, the 3 or 4 hour trip with James crying for 2 hours on the way home. You know, I can still vividly, you know, like remember the smell of the front drive after some rainfall and just how special that was to me. So that bug never left me. Then we get through to like year 10, 9 or 10. I remember as long as I live, I had no concept of what Mum and Dad were spending on private school fees, which was a small fortune for them. And I was, you know, up in the library at lunchtime through these National Geographic magazines, watching all these ringers from the top end in these sexy pictures chase yaks around and stuff. I was like, I need to leave school and go to Brunette Downs. Anyway, so you can imagine how that went when I took that back to Mum that night. She didn't slap me, but it was sort of like that verbally. And she was great. She was just like, we would like you to finish school. It wasn't quite like that. She was like, you will finish school and then we'll support you in whatever you want to do. So I think, yeah, within, you know, days of finishing school, I participated in the most overrated week of my life, which is called Schoolies, and then I was jackarooing. So I was very fortunate to go into a business called TA Fields up at Carrathool, which is between Hay and Griffith on the north side of the Murrumbidgee. I think we were 90 or 100,000 acres there. But once again, when I reflect on it, a really good management team or people that they treated us very well. They were fair but hard. All of that's changed these days. They were very, very, very hard at times, but I really respected that. When you got down and really got into the work and worked hard, you gained their respect, which we could talk about later, but that was my journey in jackarooing. And then about a year into jackarooing, I'm convinced Mum's vision was James comes back out of jackarooing and he goes to university. So I'm ringing Mum going, geez, I can count sheep 4 wide now. They bumped my pay grade accordingly. I reckon I should spend another 12 months up here. And she's like, no, you will not be spending another 12 months up there. I'd like you to come back to university and then once again, you can basically do whatever. But I think they were guiding me on keeping a lot of opportunities open instead of narrowing me into being a second year jackaroo. So that was great. Yeah, that was jackarooing. And then, yeah, came back to Melbourne to uni. Hated Melbourne again because I'd grown up there all my life, as you said. And I'd claimed a lot of independence jackarooing, and I just didn't fit into moving back in with Mum and Dad and being at uni and finding car spaces at uni and fighting with everyone else in Melbourne for what you've got to do in Melbourne. So I transferred. I had a heap of friends up at UNE at Armidale, the University of New England, and I hit Mum and Dad up to transfer halfway through. So they supported me in that once again. They were like, if you can work to pay your way, we'll cover the rest of it. And the rest went on hex or whatever, and life went on. That was great from a learning point of view because at Armidale, in some respect, there was more of a commercial focus to farming or a bigger case study component. Yeah, where you could drive out to Narrabri into, you know, sheds, you could turn a road train around in and actually stand with the grower and ask questions around how he was making a dollar from the science and the evidence that we were being taught, basically. So finished that. Then I just had this, for some reason coming out of uni, I just had this, I wanted to find businesses that had like goals, aspirations and strategy, yeah, or a corporate type nature to how they operated. So I just put myself out there, talked to a lot of people, very large corporate type families like the O'Briens out at Walgett, and ended up in a lot of other things. I think at that time, it's really interesting, you know, now we're sitting down for a livestock podcast, that I looked at the livestock industry then, which we're talking about 2005, I saw as an incredibly slow-moving old demographic of people, basically. Not a lot of tech, not much had changed. And that agronomy cropping space was very sexy at the time.
What year was that?
That's about 2005. We're at now. I'm at UNE. We're still getting lecture books with like one-way plows on the front of it, which is quite weird. But anyway, that agro cropping space was moving very quickly. We just had GPS coming in. So it was drawing a lot of people out of that small cohort of ag science students into that space. But I just think it's interesting, you know, to pause at that point and reflect on that, like where I am now and what we've got to in livestock to where I was in the early 2000s.
I think I had a similar experience around that time. We visited a cotton research institute at Narrabri for a function. And at that stage, they were very progressive and they're making incremental increases in efficiency every year. And they asked those questions of us from the New England saying, why doesn't the livestock sector move so quickly? So I think that they were very innovative at the particular point in time, weren't they?
Yeah, very much so. It was a really interesting space. Took me into a subsidiary of Sunrise called Rice Research Australia. And so we were breeding all the rice seed for the Australian rice industry. Small commercial cattle herd I was looking after for them on the side in some unarable or grazing country. And that was great. So that was my first business out of uni. Once again, just an amazing guy that I was on farm with. Just a really, really... just a really special guy, Russell Ford, who in those formative years, just so in, like it was just, yeah, they've just really formed, I reckon they've all played a role in forming who I am today. But Russell was real, I caught up with him the other day, which is just amazing, him and the family. But yeah, they were really good to me. So yeah, I did rice research and then I got a bit, lost after that. Scotty, I left Russell and actually, believe it or not, decided to go back to the farm I'm on now. So my wife's family farm at a point in time where Georgie's father wasn't ready to leave. And he was going through some really tough stuff in his life that was resulting in him having an impact on others, which is, you know, what happens at those times. So that was really tough because I'd made the move to go back. The family was fully supportive of me going back and having a crack, but it went completely pear-shaped.
Wow.
And they were incredibly dark times for me. Like I just completely went off the rails. I felt like I'd let the whole family down. I started drinking heavily. I went missing on my own family and ended up, once I got into the headspace of sitting down with this beautiful lady in Melbourne who talked me through it. The challenge was, you know, for people that have or haven't been through that, is in the early times of that, when you're thinking that the sun's not going to come up in the morning, is actually reaching out for help or recognizing the impact you're having on other people. As soon as I recognized I was having an incredibly negative and hurtful impact on those closest to me, I went and got help. And I was just very fortunate that, I suppose you could say that my family and Georgie were all, my wife Georgie were, I was going out with her at the time, were always going to be there, but they stuck with me and you somehow get out the other side. But it was just a very interesting time in my life where I, you know, had thought I was because I suppose Georgie and I could have seen ourselves there for the rest of our lives at that point in time, and it all just fell to pieces.
Well, James, look, thanks for sharing that. I think there's a few of us got one of those stories, so I appreciate you mentioning that. And it's good for people to be aware of that, especially if there's anyone listening that's going through pretty ordinary space as well. So what happened then, mate? What was the next chapter?
Yeah, so it was good. And on your point then, I think we're a lot better now, Scotty, at like reaching out to others. I reckon we've come a really long way with that, like especially, you know, over the last 3 to 5 years, the amount of mates that all check in on you and stuff. And that's, so I think that's really changed. Mate, after that, so you're in a space where you're still quite depressed, really. My self-esteem and confidence had never been lower, but I had to put myself back out to market again and present as a decent human being with having some education and look for another job. So mum once again just encouraged me to, yeah, go to these interviews basically. And I rocked up to an interview with a company called Warrakiri Cropping, which is a very large corporate at the time, on one of their farms in southwest Victoria. And I ended up getting the job as assistant manager there on farm. So that was really great. Once again, it was, you know, like they had that structure and corporate nature to how, I don't know why I was so fixated on that, but I just think it gave me the strategy and plan, and I knew where we were heading every day I went to work. So I did that, mate. And then after 2 years, they decided to sell that asset, which is once again a real turning point for me. For them, it was really about getting the right people on the right seats of the bus, really, on that farm. But as you know, people in investment sometimes choose to do, they divested the asset. So I'm sort of going, God, well, what do I do next? At that time, Warrakiri Cropping was moving from a $90 million business to $180 or a $200 million business, because the end of the life, the trust life, it happened. We'd proved that we'd demonstrated decent operating returns and they were investing in ag land again. So the new CEO came down and saw me. And I sort of off the cuff said, oh, well, would there be a role? Because a big part of my early life was missing. There wasn't enough business included in that ag science degree, yeah. And I was pretty aware of that I really needed to tidy up my business side. Would there be an opportunity back of house in the ag biz type section of the office in Melbourne? But at that point, I've then got it. So my CEO goes, I'll leave it with me. I have a think about it. And I've got to go home to Georgie and say, oh, well, I've actually sort of thrown something to the new CEO about moving back into head office in Melbourne. I'm like, well, that went down really well, you know, like Georgie going, God, I can't believe I'm moving out of the country back into Melbourne. But I got a job as assistant commercial manager down there in Queen Street, and we moved back into town. And that was a massive, massive learning curve, mate. Like, it was just phenomenal, like the scale of that business and the numbers and you know, and I suppose when those guys that had guided me into that role, and a couple of them were actually directors on the board, had made it pretty clear to me in simplistic terms that they wanted me to be a conduit between farm staff and the office function. So I'm like, well, that's cool. But there was a lot of stuff to learn in there. And you'd have these farm managers, I'll remember as long as I live, you'd have farm managers ring up. And they'd go, because they're punching some big hours, those cropping boys, like at peak times of the year. They're going, oh, I'm so sick of the boom sprayer or the spreader or something like this. I'm like, I will swap you seats in Melbourne any day of the week for getting cooked in an office, which you'd be able to relate to, Scotty, you know, like just jammed in that office from whatever time in the morning to the end of the day. But in the end, it was just an education piece, mate. It was like, you know, you had an accounting staff member that was wondering why a monthly report or something was late. But these guys had been, you know, sowing and spraying for, you know, 6 weeks, you know, reasonably sleep deprived, a lot on their plate. And the accounting member had no idea that was going on farm. Mm. It was quite an easy process to facilitate. In the end, but that was a great learning, mate, in there with a corporate. That's probably got me, that gave me a massive grounding on where I am today.
But we've spoken before, that CEO, he stayed your CEO for a period of time, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Quite formative.
Yeah. So, yeah, Adrian Goonan, was my CEO at the time. He's still involved in that business. He's a very close friend and advisor in our business today. He's been absolutely great. And I have a greater picture of what you guys have to deal with on a day-to-day basis and what I did at the time. And Adrian just had massive capacity in his role. He had so many things going on at once. and he ploughed through them very quickly. For me, being the feeling extrovert type of guy, it was greeted with some very funny office meetings where Adrian's just telling me to execute something and I'm too busy thinking, you know, like yeah. about how someone might feel on it. But we've got a great relationship, mate, and it was a massive, yeah, massive, yeah, just learning curve for me, really, and a foundation. I don't think I could be doing what we're doing today. I definitely couldn't be without the grounding I had in Melbourne.
Excellent. Yep. And we've talked a lot about that mentoring and his very straightforward application. Now, if we fast forward, so you made a decision then, you and your wife, Georgie, to then go back into the family business, didn't you?
Yeah. So I wouldn't have left Melbourne. It was a really good business. Now, they started in 1996. They'd grown to, you know, $200 million worth of land. We were putting in 80 or 90,000 hectares when I left. We were in four states, and they were really just genuinely good people.
And your role with that company was
true.
A lot of planning?
It was, mate. When it came out of my assistant commercial manager role into the ops manager for the company, operations manager for the company, which was great, there was a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. A lot of committees, a lot of facilitating decisions, a lot of, investment cases behind the scenes and steering farm staff, basically.
If you could summarise that. So you were a conduit between your farm managers and corporate, really.
Yeah.
And you were overseeing the planning of that cropping operation. And James, in just general terms, was it a lot of responsibility around budgeting, planning, and I'm imagining pretty fine margins you're operating on?
Our operating return was really solid. Yeah, from an operating perspective, let alone, you know, capital appreciation in land annually. But, mate, it'd blow some people's minds, the work that goes into planning, budgeting, investment cases, financials. Yeah.
So that really gave you that experience and basis with which then to transition into livestock. And we probably don't have the time to talk about that today, but then you and Georgie, so you've got this wealth of experience, you're living spreadsheets and trying to work with farm managers and corporate and investors and essentially owned by superannuation fund. So it's like a perfect storm, really, wasn't it?
But it was a single investor, so we were fortunate. They'd been in ag for a long time. They understood that land assets were a long game, that operating returns were volatile. We were able to smooth operating returns by having geographical spread. One of the examples we used during that expansion phase. But once again, you know, there's some really good people in that business. Yeah.
Excellent. So then you make the transition, you and Georgie, so you've got, like every family, you go through a series of discussions and you find yourself, you wake up one day, you and Bruce are at Mortlake and you've got a herd of cows. What did the business look like when you transitioned just in terms of scale and hectares?
Yeah. So Georgie was basically like, I want to go back and have a crack at the family farm. I would have never left my corporate role. It was a great family. So I decide to leave and go back, but I'm in the background, I'm thinking, shit, you know, like family succession, you know, how's this going to turn out? Because a lot of them are just a complete fail. Not a complete fail, but you know what I mean? It's complex and it's sad, sometimes sad, and it's difficult. And there's also a lot of success stories. Bruce was completely sick of the business, and probably a real benefit for Georgie and I is that he was sick of the admin or the finance function too. So straight away, we had systems and processes to develop, but we got an insight of the incomings and outgoings of the business.
And what year is this, Tom?
This is 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're 10 years in as True. We talk today.
Yeah, that's right. 2016, yeah.
Okay. Just to give people a picture, you've got, how many cows were you joining in 2016?
That's right, yeah. So we come back, we would have been calving down 800 females, And we farm a bit over 1,000 hectares. Yeah, probably 1,100 hectares or something, mate. Yeah.
Okay. So if we fast forward, before we go back and work this through, fast forward to today, how many hectares are you farming and how many cows are you?
So we farm a bit over 2,200 hectares over three farms. About 1,600 hectares broadly is allocated to grazing and the balance sharecropped. Yeah. We are calving down between 1,450 and 1,500 females this year and churn out about 1,200 weaners annually, that being steers and heifers that all get taken through to 400 to 500 kilos. Is that an okay summary?
Yeah, that's great. And for people that are listening from all over Australia and New Zealand, just tell us your rainfall and your rainfall pattern and a little bit about the area.
Yeah, so we're based 2.5 hours southwest of Melbourne, 2 hours west of Geelong in what's called the southwest region of Victoria, about 35 minutes from the coast north of a town called Warrnambool. We are based at Mortlake, and all of those properties are within 100 k's of that, or the furthest one away from Mortlake is 100 k's. We range from 660 mils of rainfall to 710.
And winter, winter distribution.
Spot on, perennial pasture-based system with a winter-dominant rainfall. We are your simplistic spring calving feeder-based model. By feeder-based, everything goes through to 400 to 500 kilos.
And so in broad terms, looking at it from the outside, in 10 years, you've essentially doubled your business. And you should be very proud, and I've visited the property on a number of occasions, and you and Bruce are mates, really, and you've got a wonderful working relationship. You've got staff, and Georgie's involved again, but quite unique that a son-in-law and a dad end up with this beautiful working relationship 10 years in and manage together to double the size of the business. So quite a credit to the family.
Yeah, that's right. I'm really grateful. Yeah, Bruce has been incredibly supportive, but in his own way. We are just such totally different people. Yeah, we think incredibly differently. You know, like if we're putting a fence line in with a big fella, we could be in the smoko room for 4 hours drawing that diagram, whereas I'm just keen to get out the door to get it done in 30 minutes, yeah?
Excellent.
That's a good example of... He has a phenomenal cow herd that I'm hoping Georgie and I can foster and continue to hold into the future. He has been incredibly great on guiding. He's getting a bit dangerous with EBVs. He was a lot easier when he didn't have numbers, I can assure you. But he's fantastic on phenotype and what the animal needs to be to produce an animal for the target market. He's always been really big on someone making money out of his animals post-farm gate. Maybe that's due to his experience in the feedlot sector and the processing sector back in the day. But in a nutshell, mate, he's taught me a hell of a lot. Our relationship can be quite challenging at times because we're such totally different thinkers. I've just got so big picture as we've grown, and I just like to get on with shit, and he's still wanting to talk about stuff in the smoko room. But yeah, great guy. Right. Yeah, great guy.
So James, about 5 years ago, we met a previous president of Bankers Australia, Brad Gilmore, and I was staying with Brad. We went to Mortlake. We were heading to a Victorian Angus meeting. He said, jump in the car with James and drive to Ballarat. We hadn't met each other. And it was a fantastic car trip. And I just remember the enthusiasm with which you talked about your business, your spreadsheets, your planning, your running your operation on numbers like I hadn't heard before. Can you just outline to the listeners today, how did you essentially, you and Georgie, grow that business? And what are the levers, what are the drivers for you that you plan? What drives the Sisters Pastoral Company? And how did you achieve that sort of growth? It's quite extraordinary.
It's business growth and what people that are listening and what they've achieved is not something we reflect on enough or pat ourselves on the back for enough in ag. It's times like this where I'm off farm and having like a fireside chat like this where I get to reflect on it. I'm incredibly proud of how many more kilos of beef per hectare we've churned out. That's one thing we are doing really well, that improvement. Mate, it's a big question, but we came back and the first thing you need to do is have a crack at a plan. I knew I'd need some money and we'd need to have the financial literacy and the plan and the strategic document to get a bank on side or the bank on side. So in a nutshell, mate, we wrote a strategic plan. The start of that's like a plan. Then we had some visions and values, like how we want to operate and what we really, how we want to behave and operate and what we value in life. It ended up being like a 70 or 80 page document. So I came back wanting to have similar systems and processes at home to what I had in Queen Street, basically. So now there is an accounts payable function. There's a management reporting software program and there's a day-to-day operational software program as well. And they all basically feed in together. I think that's the first point to make. You can have a plan, but you've got to have the systems and processes around it to execute it. And I needed that, mate, because I needed to start gathering a whole heap of data because you can't manage what you don't measure. So we needed to have the numbers around us to make some decision. Where were we? Got into benchmarking really early, you know, and that straight away highlights where you are compared to other people that are running beef businesses on the southeastern seaboard. And we also do that per 100 mils of rainfall.
And you're still undertaking
most definitely
benchmarking today?
Most definitely, mate. Most powerful thing we've done.
And how would you describe that transition? What does the business look like today? You went from an autumn calving herd to a spring. What's some of the other changes that happened there?
Yes. So my father-in-law changed. So my father-in-law got into Angus in the early 90s from a demand he saw in the feed. He was heavily involved in feeding cattle at the time or owning cattle that were going on to feed. So he saw a big change there. So he made that change. And then he also changed to the feeder model in his generation. So he got into Angus and he also changed to a feeder model where he's selling feeder steers, or 400 to 500 kilo stuff, But he was calving in autumn. And that's, you know, and that's another really important thing on your question about where we're at when we got back. You have to have the right enterprise and system if you want to maximize profit. Maximizing profit's not for everyone, but this is a business for me. So autumn calving, when I looked at it and got into benchmarking, I'm not trying to sound outspoken, but for our business and my supply and demand grass curve, animals on top of grass, autumn calving made no sense. So when we got back, we were feeding every single female less than maintenance, but rolling around with hay twice a day, every day from March through to August, every single female.
It's a big cost and a big labour.
And completely not scalable, Scotty. Like you cannot, that's the, you know, those guys I really respect in that benchmarking group. You want to have pretty thick skin going into some of these benchmarking groups, but, you know, just we had a vision to scale the business and it wasn't going to happen autumn calving. So, yep, you know, while it sounds like a quantum shift, Georgie just walked in one day and just said, like, I'll support you. If your number suggests that we're not going to lose too much in this, just let's roll the last 500 or 600 cows over to a spring calving, which is what we did. And we've never looked back. Okay. Apart from the drought last year, we haven't fed a female post-weaning apart from the drought.
And does that mean do you do fodder conservation now still?
Oh, I'm just finding fodder conservation's incredibly expensive for what we get back in return.
So for listeners that might not appreciate the system, you would be stockpiling and using that as a maintenance ration after, like, you're keeping that feed in the paddock. Then once you've weaned your calves each year and you've got cows on a low maintenance, that's essentially your system.
Spot on. So back in, yeah, so fodder conservation typically down there is we cut grass in spring that we can't eat, like the spring surplus, and we put it into a bale or a pit, and it's in the spring calving feeder system, it's fed back to a weaner post-weaning, and we just turn the cows out, and if they lose a bit of weight, well, so be it. They don't have to do anything until August anyway, yeah?
Yep.
I'm struggling with the cost of fodder conservation doing that operation, baling hay, putting stuff in a pit. So we're actually deferring a fair bit of feed now. If we can't catch it in spring, like you said, there'll be 20 or 30 hectares that 600 or 700 cows get locked in post-weaning and they eat it to the boards, and it buys me 30 or 40 days in autumn while we're waiting for green feed.
Excellent. And you're also using a condition on your cows as a lever as well.
Condition on cows is a massive lever, mate. A massive, massive lever. And that was so pleasing to see yesterday, that the friends that I saw yesterday, they have a massive lever on those cows' back. They've done an incredible job. I know they've got a long way to go through the winter on the northern tablelands. They've got a massive lever on the back of those cows. The cows I saw would still be 3.5 to 4 score, you know, up there. Yeah. It's a huge lever in that spring calving. For us to dust 50 kilos off a cow's back from weaning, if not more, 50 kilos from weaning through to August, it's like water off a duck's back to me. Okay. Yeah.
Would you mind just in a 12-month cycle, James, for people who don't understand your system, can you tell us from which month do you calve, which month do you wean, and could you just give us the quick 12-month summary?
Yeah, spot on. So we calve, heifers will calve in July. Late July, cows come on board in August from the 1st of August. Bulls are going out on the 25th of October. We'll give you your first calf date of the 1st of August. So we've got a cow, if we just pause on that and say we're calving then and we're joining in the 25th of October in my system, calves are on a rising plane of nutrition and sort of doing cartwheels on the 25th of October. But in the autumn system, we were joining on the 25th of May, and under a certain stocking rate, cows are looking into a black hole. We now join on the 25th of October and everything's looking up, like stuff's flying. Then we will wean based on the cow's condition score in January or February. When do we wean in January? When we've had maybe a tight spring or when that drought was on, we get calves off mum, so she's got a bit more nick on her back. Generally weaning in February, and then all of that progeny that we wean at 240 to 260 kilos gets sold as a feeder the following spring, or to a 400 to 500 kilo animal in the following spring.
Direct to a feedlot.
We're direct to a feedlot, yeah.
And in terms of your heifer calves in replacements, what are you doing there?
Yeah, so growth's been, we don't run the most fertile herd. Some of that's the environmental pressure I put on them. And we've grown a fair bit since we've got back. So a lot of those heifers have come through for the journey. And we've also had to buy some females along the way. I'm not afraid to buy females. They just get a colour tag. And if we don't want them down the track, will they get sold? A lot of those heifers have come through. Empties will typically get sold on Auctions Plus, and they're going back to repeat buyers to go on feed.
And those weaners, are they getting any fodder, James, now, or are they on a pasture system?
Yeah. So we switched. I've got a real issue with pink eye at home. We don't need to go into that. What's changed, mate, in the drought, I fed those weaners in containment with pellets for the first time. Not really, sexy or high protein or ME pellet, but from the day we started feeding pellets in confinement and containment in a cloud of dust, which should be horrendous for pink eye, we never treated another eye. So I've gone with pellets again this year. I'm feeling like pink eye on my farm looks like it could be quite linked to the nutrition they're getting post the weaning yard.
Oh, well,
I feel like. So, yes, they get supplementary fed until the point I've got enough green grass. They're being rotated anyway, but enough green grass that we can pull sup feed out and do everything on grass, which is my cheapest form of weight gain.
And then spring, you're capitalising on that feed cycle that you've got, and you're turning those steers off late spring.
Spot on, mate. By September in our system, when I look at the OptiWay data on our steers and heifers, broadly we're seeing 1.5 kilos by September a day, and then we're probably peaking late October, November at 2 kilos a day on them. So spring is doing, once again, like when I talk about that enterprise and system, the whole enterprise and system is based around harvesting as much grass as we can in the spring and letting the spring do the heavy lifting for us. I am not concerned if a weaner is doing 300, 400, 500 grams through the middle of winter, as long as I've got a heap around me that's going to utilize as much as my spring feed as possible, because spring takes care of it in the end. Yeah.
That's excellent, James. That's such a good overview. Now, you alluded just then to an OptiWay system. Before, we're just having a look at your phone. You've just put holder collars on some cows. Can you just briefly mention what are the key technologies that you're using in your system? You might reflect on fixed time AI or not.
Yeah.
We've had interesting chats over that over the time. Yeah, what are the key technology drivers that you've used and then maybe that you're deciding not to use going forward?
Yeah. I wouldn't say we're bleeding edge early adopters, mate, but tech's got us a long way as the business has grown. Can't be across everything as much. In the early days, you know, that was like AgriWeb, the software program, getting a handle of our daily operations. That moved through to electric fence monitoring has been huge. Water monitoring's obviously huge, all done from the iPhone now. And then we had this thing called OptiWay come along, which started to measure cattle in the paddock. Really pleasing, you know, to see bits. I caught up with Bill Mitchell, the owner, yesterday, which is just so bloody exciting catching up with Bill. But to see AgTech like that OptiWay unit have such a, add so much value to the business, you know. Like I said to Bill yesterday, like, I don't think we even realize we're doing it, but, you know, you're looking at that app once or twice a day as the, you know, as Bill explained to me, as a feedback loop to what's actually happening in the paddock. So that was, there's an OptiWay in both the weaner mobs and it gets rotated with them. Maybe with these collars we've invested in now, you know, whether I work with Bill to get an OptiWay into those collared cattle as well. But I'll get to that anyway. So OptiWay has been absolutely pivotal. Yes, we have taken the plunge with halter collars. It was really hard for me to get my head around the investment case due to the cost of those collars. There's no secrets here. Scotty, I was like, well, how about I just lift stocking rate using my net profit per DSE, lift my stocking rate to have the collar break even. So all the sales gump I'm getting filled with at the start, I'll take that as profit, but we've broken even to start with. Because if you lift stocking rate on a certain area of your farm, there's more hectares that become available for other animals, times by your kilos of beef per hectare, times by your price received annually, gets you to a number. So we're paid for before we started. We've had 500 go on and I've collared the pregnant heifers just because I thought with AI fetuses, two lots of backup bulls or the timings of those fetuses, we might be able to use the tech quite neatly during calving and stuff. It is, but we are only 2 weeks in and it is phenomenal.
Wow.
I've been saying to friends, I don't want to sound like an F-wit, but this is absolutely groundbreaking stuff, especially once they get the animal activity and repro stuff out to us in June. All of those questions I've been racking my brain on since we started in beef, we've suddenly got some data behind.
Excellent.
And meeting with Bill yesterday, we looped the OptiWays into the halter collars. We've got a feedback loop on average daily gain.
Fantastic.
Could talk about it for hours, mate.
That's great. That's great. We might have you at a conference doing that.
No.
That's excellent. What's amazing to me is sometimes you're not an adopter. So, for example, we've had interesting chats about management tags. Then you've gone to holder. What's your thinking, business thinking there? Tell the listeners, because I think I understand it reasonably well. Why are you not an adopter of some technologies or things that we take practices that we take for granted in the beef industry, and then others, you'll make a judgment call. And how do you make that judgment call?
Yeah. So my exposure to the corporate world heavily ingrained in me that you need to get a return for every dollar spent, and that'll vary for different businesses, the return hurdle. So that's simplistically where I'm at on business decisions. I do a lot of numbers. I'm definitely not the most intelligent guy. There are so many facets of our business I need to improve. We are not the most profitable beef producer out there. It's just sort of a way of thinking for me, I reckon, Scotty. But if we loop back to that particular example with a collar, you know, like I've seen from rotational grazing alone before the collars, I've just seen such a massive increase in production because your weaner platform does a lot of heavy lifting for kilos of beef per hectare. Yeah, if we're taking a 250 kilo animal to 450 kilos, it's a lot of beef per hectare once you start stacking 3 to the hectare in a paddock. And it's allowed to me rotational grazing and having a system and process around that has found me very in control of my business. And so I'm a control freak, but I like to know where the business is at in any point in time. And I think my mindset over the last few years has led me more towards being a grass manager than a cattle manager. We just use the cattle to harvest grass.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a great answer, James. Now, listeners may or may not know, you've got a good reputation in the industry for selling quality feeder steers. You've got you've won a number of carcass or feedlot trials, awards. So you're well positioned and people seek your cattle out. So it's a real compliment to yourself, Georgie and Bruce, that you've managed to position yourself really well, and there's some good reasons for that. But, mate, tell us, when you're buying your bull battery, tell us about your decision-making process. It's pretty important. A lot of seed stock producers will be listening to that. How do you go about your purchasing decisions? What are you looking for? And what's going through your mind?
Yeah. So we take it pretty seriously. In the early days, and I think it's still relevant today, very phenotype focus. So we had, I've seen some big issues in feet when I first started. This is 2016. I was very sick of tipping out cows that were pregnant for the second time with feet. Really frustrated, actually, but that's left me now. We seem to have tidied up the job on that. My father-in-law's very good at the phenotype stuff and explaining to me the type of animal we need to produce an outcome. And then I basically come in with numbers over the top of that. The challenge with all the numbers is there's a lot of information these days. So I probably look at too much information. Angus Tech is a big one for me because I can dump all of those catalogs into an Excel spreadsheet out of Angus Tech and play with it. I've got my own bull team in there that I can also critically look at. To answer your question on what we look for, we're essentially trying to produce a fertile, functional female with good growth and good carcass attributes, in a nutshell. How do we do that? We look at a lot of stuff, but we're also looking at EBVs that'll be relevant, or metrics that'll be relevant post the farm gate. For example, 600 day weight and carcass stuff. The feedlot trial competition we're in has been pivotal because we've been able to demonstrate in a commercial setting that we have cattle with a lot of growth.
So you've been able to use that success in that trial to demonstrate to your buyers, essentially?
No, so I think I think if we just stick on ourselves for a second, it's been able to hone my focus today on what I'm looking for in an Angus bull.
Excellent.
Right? Yeah. And it's very evident in that, you know, people far more educated than me, Scotty, in all this breeding stuff, mate. But what's coming out quite strongly in that feedlot is that we have herds that are very strong in carcass, very strong in growth. But when we actually look at them, all the top 10, there's not many of them that match up completely and shoot the lights out on both.
Got it.
Yeah. So I'm trying to hone our direction without selecting on single traits where we balance some of the carcass stuff. Would be very flippant as a commercial producer to say, oh, well, I don't get paid for that. I just want to make it very clear with this amazing relationship we've got with the feedlot is there's one question they ask me, and that's where my recent bulls rank on IMF as an ABV.
That's fascinating.
That's a very interesting question.
Because I hear this conversation all the time, James. So I have people say we're not paid for IMF. Why do we select for it? And I often say to them, it's market access is the reason. And essentially, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. They're obviously seeing data that unfortunately I don't see. And let's not open up a can of worms. But unfortunately, that feedback loop of information just really bloody poor, mate, in the industry for me. Like, you know, if I want to improve on farm, where's all my average daily gains out of the feedlot and all the carcass data? Because that's how I could improve, but we just don't get that. So I won't harp on that. It's just a bloody frustration. They will be seeing carcass stuff on up there. So they're going like, these guys are flying growth-wise. And I look at all the individual average daily gains in the office when I'm at the feedlot. They're asking those questions because they're probably not, I'm happy to admit, they're probably not performing as well as they'd like to on IMF, and that's fine. Like,
and when you're buying those genetics, what percentile ranking are you looking for you?
Now we're getting really pointy. Mate, I'm honing EMA and IMF right up the top of the,
top quartile?
Definitely.
Further than that?
If I can, I'm just pretty miserable, mate, so I don't want my bull purchase to escape commercial reality.
Right, that's great. I think you've given us some great information there, James.
Sorry, mate. We look at heaps of ABVs, though, Scotty, and I just think once you can dump that stuff into a spreadsheet, including being able to use AI, we can develop some really cool stuff in there to hone what I'm bidding on those days. Yeah.
Now, James, another interesting watching your business. You would think a guy that runs numbers and spreadsheets like you do perhaps might swap and change around with providers and customers. But actually, your business is very stable in terms of, and we don't need to mention brand names here, but
yeah,
where you're selling your store, where you're buying your bulls from, and where you finance doesn't change much, does it? You've got great partnerships. Do you want to talk about how that works for you? You still use data, but it's one of your core philosophies is working with partners, isn't it?
Yeah, mate. So if you look at our values, quality relationships is there. I'm massive on relationships, mate. I love people. My tolerance for F-wits is getting very slim in my older age. I'm really strong on relationships, mate. And we're surrounded by some just amazing people, really amazing people. So it's all about relationships for me, mate. Sometimes, you know, they have to change, but it will be very clear from both sides, you know, why that's had to happen.
That's very interesting looking from the outside that you're very stable with your relationships. You do have deep relationships with people, and that flows to your staff too, doesn't it, James? And you might just quickly mention for the M&FTEs, would you run that herd with, James?
Mate, we would be back to 2.5, I suppose. On the 14 or 1500 females that are calving and the 1200 reiners and a few other things that run around like bulls. Pretty skinny, but we've got to remember that one of the strongest attributes beef's got for it, or commercial cattle's got for it, is that, you know, like its scalability. For every few hundred you add over 1,000, you hardly notice it there, which came from, you know, a great guy when we were sort of at that point. And it was true. I just think more of my role, Scotty's, you know, just a bit sick of the admin and the organisation stuff that's coming in when you're trying to steer the ship. But, mate, we've got a great team. So it's Georgie, myself now, and Tom, who, while I was away recently on something, or last year, decided he'd send in an application for Jen Angus, and I'm very proud of him and everyone else that's in that cohort for having a crack. So he's up here, mate. But he is, rightly or wrongly, maybe I bucked the trend, but he is like a family member to me.
Well,
when I was in the trenches last year with an adjustment thing that went pear-shaped, like he's just, like he just would move heaven and earth for me, and he's just like working with a, you know, mate and a family member, basically. I'm very lucky. I just, you know, people that are good to me, I just try to treat really well. Yeah.
That's great, James. That's excellent. You could look from the outside and think everything's been great planning, great business background, put a big, nice, clean plan into place, 10 years, executed well. But knowing you, you've had the challenges too. In that time, you had great wins and need to be commended for that. Hit the wall a couple of times too. And, yeah, as a family, do you support one another, you and Georgie, through those mixed times, let's call it good and bad and otherwise, and with Tom?
Yeah, so personalities are complex, but I'm a big one for trying to understand and find people interesting. So, yeah, people cope with things differently, you know, pretty clear with me as per this conversation, you know, there are no secrets, nothing's off the table, and I wear my heart on my sleeve. I'm a very driven person, and Georgie not so. So it's great being married to someone who's not only my best mate but is very different. Like, home is very relaxing and a very safe space for me, even if it's turmoil outside. So that's really powerful, like, having her. Like, she's just a rock, you know? Like, and I don't think in ag we, you know, appreciate what those people are doing for us farmers, like, to have a meal, you know, for them to be worried about where we are, like, all this bullshit stuff we do where we say we're going to be home in 15 minutes and it turns out to be 15 hours later, you know? Like, I just think that's a really critical role for me, or Georgie, yep. And I'm just, I've just got a fantastic network of people, mate. You know, like in those, you know, some podcasts I've done, they ask for your mentor. I've got so many mentors, but none of those people would know that they actually are.
Wow.
But I have such a deep respect and interest in what they do that, you know, we're speaking to each other so frequently. And when the going gets tough, we're also checking in on each other. So, yeah, when I think it'd just be, you know, it's probably tough for some of those other people too. Like when I hit the wall last year, like I've never been so mentally or physically disturbed in my life going through that, you know, animal welfare type crisis I had when things unraveled on me, you know, what was that? 15, 17 hours away from home last year, it'd be horrendous in Georgie's position, you know. But once again, like those dark times, it just, you sort of just close in on yourself and it's actually self-preservation. But some of those stories that come out of that, like...
they were tough for you.
They were, mate. But when you got people like, you know, like my lead vet... I remember waking up at 2:30 in the morning and I just could have thrown up in bed, you know, like things were that bad. And I thought of my lead vet and what he'd do in this situation. And Woody was on annual leave on a boat or something, like sailing with his family. And I got hold of him the following morning and he said, "Nida, I love you like a brother. If you ever need to call me at 2:30 in the morning, just do it." You know, like,
I've got
truck drivers I've never met before that were climbing into a loaded B-double to bag a cow for me that went down in transit, you know? Like, this is really powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a really, you know, and the two families that saved me on that job and took my cattle, you know, like, there are some beautiful people out there. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know... just a big part of my life, those people. You know, publicly, I just, you know, a lot of those people should know who they are. It just means the world to me, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those great stories of the Angus community.
Yeah.
And through that tough time, James and I talk pretty often. And
yeah,
there was those couple of families were extraordinary to James and his family. And they just, the generosity is is quite special, isn't it?
Yeah,
There's no other way to say it.
They're amazing, mate. I was very fortunate to have people on the Northern Tablelands and, the Post family at Gyra and the McDougall family at Glen Innes, Henry's folks that, saved me. I was very fortunate to have a core group of friends up here, mate. And I got a really great network up here, and they were just the be all and end all last year. I've never been so low before in my life. But we got through, mate. And we move on. It's just, I've just been reflecting on it a lot over the last few months.
Fantastic, James. James, time's starting to draw to a close. How do you get your information? How do you learn? How do you keep fresh? Obviously, your network is enormous. So you're talking to people all the time. Every time I see you on the phone, you've got this great network. What are other ways, especially if you're giving some guidance to younger people? How do you learn?
Yeah, true. Yeah, so I'm incredibly curious, and I'm happy to challenge the norm. I'll just keep asking questions, but have some evidence and stuff behind that or data behind that before you fire away. I suppose I just do a lot of thinking too, mate. But you're right. When you said that, I do reach out to a lot of people on certain things like sounding boards. I would gather a lot of information based on that.
From which you can then do your own.
Yeah, or they send through, like, for example, information to me on email and I'll read that. I just find myself, my mind wanders when I read. I know you're a big reader, but my mind just wanders. Like if I'm reading, I'm trying to skip through the Land and the Weekly Times to see, whether there's anything remotely, interesting in either of those papers, which it really is. I do look at a lot of papers, dig into a lot of data, know my own business really well. I'm involved in, a few groups. I'm quite entrenched in the Angus community as far as being on state committee or chair of the state committee now.
And that came about, as we know, because you had too much time left over.
Yes,
at the end of the week.
That's right. I was reflecting on that. I'm like, all these people that put their hand up for these things are actually the busiest people in the world that volunteer for these roles, so it all just gets a bit complicated in the end. But it's a good question. I hadn't reflected on that information piece, Scotty, but I've got a lot at hand and think about a lot of things. We measure a lot of stuff, and then I just use stuff that's out there to try and validate it or work out whether it's valuable or not.
So James, pretty important question for you. You're a commercial success story in the Angus cow-calf business. What would be a message to a lot of people listening today would be seed stock producers, good, bad or otherwise? This is an opportunity to speak to the Angus community. What are we doing well? What are we doing poorly? And where does the attention of Angus breeders need to be going forward, James?
Yeah, so you're very kind. I don't know how successful we've been yet. We just continue to try and tweak the system and be a little bit better each year is the first point. We've got a long way to go. I don't know why, I find the Angus breed and Angus Australia as a business and the membership base so interesting, but I've never been involved in an organisation or this type of organisation where you've got a membership base like this. What I've been reflecting on a lot is those, evolution of business curves, Especially now while we look at, trialing or having a sneak peek at a new genetic platform. It's like, how does the membership base and the breed continue to stay relevant and be at the top of their game in 10 years' time or 5 or 10 years' time? I've been thinking about that a lot. In my early days in the Angus breed, maybe there's still some relevance today, are the seed stock producers aligned to commercial producers? I'm trying to challenge people's thinking here because I know that the KPIs for both those businesses are very, very different. We are stocking rate and kilos of beef focused. Plenty of, like, feel free for any Seedstock member to call me and challenge me on this. But a Seedstock member's job is to be on top of their game in communications and marketing, produce an animal that's fit for type in a commercial herd, but sell it for the maximum amount of price. It's blunt, but it's real. So in my early days, I'm like, oh, well, is there a disconnect between Seedstock and commercial? And I think it'd be remiss of me not to mention this in the podcast, that we just be mindful of that. My females are expected to really be in their work clothes a fair portion of the time. So are we producing an Angus bull that is going to be able to, you know, produce progeny that copes in that sort of environment? I'm not trying to get off track here, but it's just one point of interest. Therefore, going forward, I believe this genetics and this data, which sounds weird because I truly believe that phenotype's important, but bear with me. The data set that we have is really, really powerful. And the Angus brand is really, really strong. And you can see, you would only have to speak to my father-in-law to look at how that's developed and how certain regions, you know, you'd be pushed to find anything else in them now.
Mm.
But how do we, on that curve of evolution, continue to stay relevant or reinvent ourselves? I don't have all the answers, Scotty, but as a membership base, we need to really take a step back at times and look at the big picture and not put the blinkers on and close in on ourselves. We need to, we just need to keep a big picture mindset on where we're headed. And I believe the data is going to play a big part in that.
No, I think you've covered it really well. The only question I might just tease out a little bit, mm-hmm. if you have a trade focus going forward for a commercial operator, what would be the three top trait focuses that you would like to see the breed working more on?
Wow, jeepers, mate. It's a pretty pointed question, big fella. We're seeing quite a few feedlots change hands. Is that Angus space and that Angus feeding program's going to look different over the next 5 years? I've got a hand on heart, say it is. Breed content, that sort of stuff. It's a big question that, like, where do we head? But anyway, mate, your three things. So I have a herd of my own that I've got to steer the direction on, like you have to steer the direction of the membership base. My job's far easier than yours, given the cows don't talk back, Scotty. I would say it's carcass characteristics for us. So I would be EMA, IMF at the moment, and probably mature body composition.
Mm. Okay.
Because I've probably learned, how those things interact. I think, mate, as a breed, once again, not trying to be outspoken, but what I'm seeing in the commercial world is that we have coupled low birth weight with early gestation to nearly the bleeding edge.
Mm.
And under environmental pressure during calving, rightly or wrongly, we're seeing mortality rates increase in calves. Just one thing I reckon from that, if we look at like the data set and where we've been, I've done it too. I don't try to buy low birth weight bulls, but I need to protect myself when we're joining 600 heifers, say, that I have some protection there and we're not pulling a heap. I'm happy to assist a few. I just think we've driven both those characteristics for where I'm getting, things that are born like little dogs 23 days in front of the due date, you know? So I think these are real commercial examples that could be quite interesting if can somehow be fed back to Seedstock. But for us, mate, it's carcass. I don't, I actually shouldn't comment because I don't have the education base or the understanding of where we should head. But for my particular herd, I just like to pull the socks up on carcass a bit. But I don't want to jeopardize the growth because we know how much money or the correlation to profit growth is in a feedlot. Yeah.
Oh, thanks, James. That's a really comprehensive answer. So I appreciate you're straightforward answer in that regard. So, mate, I really appreciate that. Time's running out, James. We really have appreciated your time. What's your best beef eating experience you've ever had?
I won't try and make this too warm and fuzzy, but Georgie and I try and break the year up, mate, and get into Melbourne and just book a night or two without the kids, which is great. Like, just getting off farm is really important. And just getting, like, you know, not back together, but you know what I mean, just without the kids and, you know, book a nice meal and stuff. So we're very fortunate. We don't really stuff around with eating at cheaper restaurants are those nights. So I can only, yeah, George, you'll love this, but, it, you know, the company's great and the beef's always good, mate. And, you know, we eat some beautiful steaks down there, mate. So I'm pretty fortunate to have that experience a few times a year, to be honest. Yeah, yeah.
No, thanks. Thanks, James. James, I want to thank you for, as always, you wear your heart on your sleeve. You have been very open in this podcast. You're a really giving person in terms of giving back to the breed. And already you've left a legacy with Jen Angus, which is great. And you continue to come each year to encourage those young people. So we're very thankful for that. Thank you for your leadership of the Victorian State Committee. I know that's through a whole lot of your calendar. Just want to say thank you. Thank you for just being such a passionate member of the Angus breed. You were gave such a great testimony on our promotional work for the World Angus Forum. Became a movie star for 3 minutes, so we appreciate that. And great to have you on today, James.
No, thanks heaps, Scotty, and thanks for the friendship, mate. I appreciate the sounding board and you're looking out for me. Yeah, cheers, mate.
Thanks, James.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.